Well, in honor of Mother's Day, I want to put our study through the Gospel of John on hold this week and look at a story about a mother. This story is a beautiful portrayal of the heart of the Lord toward the rejected and the downcast. And mothers certainly feel that way at times, but not just mothers. If you have ever experienced rejection, ever felt like you got the beat down by life, if you've ever felt taken for granted, used, abused, forgotten, helpless, outmatched, this story is for you. So let's turn to Genesis chapter 16. Genesis chapter 16. And we'll start reading in the very first verse. It says, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar, who she said to Abram, so she said to Abram, 'The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her.' Abram agreed to what Sarai said." Now, I want to begin by saying that not everything you read in the Bible should be considered a good example to follow. And here's a case in point. Because we should, as a general practice, have children with our own wife or own husband, not with a maidservant, not with the gardener, nobody else, okay? So let's just get that cleared up and taken care of before we get any further. The other thing I want to say is that as we go through this story today, you'll read Sarai and Abram being referred to in this story, but their names are changed later on to Sarah and Abraham, and that's how I will often refer to them as we're speaking today, as Sarah and Abraham, even though in this particular place in Genesis, they're referred to as Sarai and Abram, same people, they just changed their names a little later on. Okay, now a little bit of background to get us to Genesis chapter 16. The Lord made a promise to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12 that he would make Abraham into a great nation of people with many descendants. There was a small problem with this promise that the Lord had made to Abraham, though. The woman that Abraham is married to is unable to have children. No children, no descendants. No descendants, no great nation. No great nation, failed promise. Well, after several years, God and Abraham have another conversation in Genesis chapter 15. And there, Abraham asked the Lord if one of his servants should be his heir, since he's not been able to have any children up to this point. And this sounded like a reasonable plan. It was not an uncommon thing for this type of thing to actually be done in that time and culture under circumstances like this, where there is someone who doesn't have any children, and you would choose one of your servants, a trusted servant, to then be your heir. But the Lord made it very clear to Abraham, saying to him, "A son coming from your own body will be your heir." Well, more time passes, and still no children. And that brings us to where we are here in Genesis chapter 16. Sarah, his wife, had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar. So she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Now, believe it or not, this was an acceptable thing to do in that time and culture, that you would choose a surrogate mother to have children on your behalf if you were unable to have children. Sarah is often criticized by Bible readers for what she does in this story, but before we judge Sarah too quickly, we should realize that her options are very limited. I mean, let's put ourselves in her circumstances for just a moment. They have been in Canaan 10 years now and still have no children. She and Abraham are both getting beyond the age of having children. Abraham is 85, Sarah is 75. Can I assume that most of the women here today would consider themselves beyond the age of having children at the age of 75? Yes? Okay. Same with Sarah. There was tremendous pressure in that culture for a woman to provide her husband with a son to carry on the family name. Added to that was the promise that the Lord had made to Abraham that he would have many descendants. Well, now, you as Abraham's wife, the one who would, under normal circumstances, bear these children, are unable to get pregnant. From your perspective, you would feel like the one standing in the way of the fulfillment of the Lord's promise and plan for your husband, Abraham. It's your fault that things have not worked out the way they're supposed to. You feel like you have to come up with a way for this promise to be fulfilled for your husband's sake, regardless of the cost to you personally. Sarah had probably laid awake at night for weeks, for months, even years, thinking through her options. And the only solution that she could come up with, short of a miracle from God, was to give her maidservant to her husband as a surrogate mother, so they could finally build a family. Well, as unbelievable as it might sound, the Lord actually wanted her and Abraham to wait for the miracle of God. That happened to be God's plan for them. Sometimes waiting for God's miracle is our option too. I think one of the things that led to Sarah's impatience with God's promise was her taking on too much of the responsibility for the fulfillment of it. She was saying, "It must be my fault. I need to do something about it to fix it." But in truth, there was nothing for her to fix. There was nothing that she had done wrong. It was just the way things were. The same thing can be true in our lives, can't it? Sometimes things are not working out the way we think they should, and we can mistakenly think that we have done something to cause that. Somehow we need to do something to fix it. But there's nothing to fix. It's just the way things are in our life. See, God has a different timetable than we do. And he has a completely different set of priorities than us. God has a plan, and he will see that it is fulfilled. Trust him. Give him the load. Don't try to carry this thing yourself. It will smother you. It will crush you. Wait for the Lord. Wait for his miracle. Wait for his hand to move. Well, Abraham agreed to what Sarah said. He agrees to go along with this plan that Sarah has come up with. He's just as guilty as she is at this point of living by sight rather than by faith. Remember, back in chapter 15, Abraham asked the Lord if his intention was to have him adopt one of his servants, namely Eleazar, as his heir. And the Lord told him a son coming from his own body would be his heir. Well, now in chapter 16, Sarah suggests that they build a family through one of her servants. I mean, isn't this plan really just a variation on the same plan? God had made it clear to Abraham and Sarah that he intended for a son to come from the two of them. But that seemed like an impossibility to them. It defied all reason and sane thinking as far as they were concerned. They would ask themselves the question, how can a baby come from an 85-year-old man and a 75-year-old woman? And the answer kept coming back to them, it's impossible. It can't happen. But nothing is impossible with God. So in verse 3 it says, so after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarai his wife took her Egyptian maidservant Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar and she conceived. So right off the bat, Hagar conceives. So we know that the problem was with Sarah, not Abraham. It's important for us to keep that in mind. It'll help us to understand Sarah and Abraham's reaction to this situation that develops over the next few verses. Because Sarah will be understandably upset on a variety of levels, which we will talk about in a moment. Abraham, on the other hand, he's pretty passive about the whole thing. I mean, for him, things are working out pretty good. I mean, he now has two women to enjoy as wives, and he's getting the child that he's always wanted. I mean, life is good for Abraham. This plan that Sarah came up with is a good plan. It's working out just fine. Or is it? Verse 4, it continues, it says, when she, Hagar, knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress, Sarai. Then Sarai said to Abram, you are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. I put my servant in your arms, and now she knows she's pregnant. She despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me. Hey, your servant is in your hands, Abram said. Do with her whatever you think best. Then Sarai mistreated Hagar, so she fled from her. Uh-oh. So things are not so good after all. And as we put ourselves into the shoes of each of these people, we can begin to understand why each of them reacts the way they do. I mean, consider Hagar first. It says she began to despise her mistress. Hagar was a personal servant of Sarah's. Servants had no rights or privileges. She's accustomed to being told what to do, never asked her opinion. She was a nobody, barely a human being. But now Hagar has suddenly been promoted to the position of concubine. And now that she's pregnant with her master's only child, she's achieved something that her mistress, Sarah, was never able to do. It's understandable that she would be tempted to feel more important than her place allowed. Begin to see Sarah as an equal and perhaps even as someone inferior to herself. Sarah is upset on a number of different levels, and she's upset at everybody. She's terribly hurt and mad at Hagar for all the attitude that she's getting from her now. Hagar had probably been one of Sarah's most trusted servants, if not her most trusted servant, who she feels has now betrayed her. Remember that Sarah had personally selected Hagar to be the woman to bear their children. This was certainly not the only servant that Abraham and Sarah had to choose from. But Hagar is chosen as that person to carry this very special role out in their family. Sarah trusted her, but now she feels she's betrayed her. This person that she has allowed to come into their closer circle that only Abraham and Sarah had occupied before, she feels like she's getting stabbed in the back. She's mad at herself for having come up with this plan that is now backfiring on her in ways that she had never anticipated. And in typical human fashion, she's blaming others for things that she has responsibility for. She's hurt and mad at her husband, Abraham, because she doesn't feel like he's supporting her the way that he ought to. The text doesn't say it, but I would guess that Abraham is probably showing Hagar more attention now than Sarah thought that he should. He had probably ignored Hagar before now. She was just one of Sarah's servants. But now that she's carrying his child, he's doting over her. Oh, let me help you with that. Oh, you better sit down. Take it easy. Sarah, can you get her a glass of water and an extra pillow? Now, in fairness to him, the expectations put on him by Sarah are impossible for him to meet at this point. I mean, he and Hagar have done more than shake hands. And this young woman is carrying the child of his dreams. Abraham tells Sarah, oh, do with her whatever you want. whatever you think best. He puts on this air of disinterest in the whole thing, but I think he's a man caught in the middle, and he really doesn't know what to do. Well, once Abraham gives Sarah permission, she begins to mistreat Hagar. And I can almost hear Sarah thinking to herself, if this little Egyptian maid of mine thinks that she's going to take my place in this house, she has another thing coming. I'm going to make her life so miserable that I will drive her from this home. And that's exactly what she does. It gets so bad that Hagar feels her only recourse is to run away. She decides to run away, go back to her homeland of Egypt. So Hagar becomes the victim, caught in the middle of this train wreck between Sarah and Abraham. Verse 7, it says, the angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that is beside the road to Shur. And he said, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from? And where are you going? I'm running away from my mistress Sarai, she answered. So the Lord, in the form of this angel, comes to Hagar out in the middle of the desert, and he begins to have a conversation with her. And he asks her where she's come from and where she's going, even though he knows all about what's been going on. And it reveals in a beautiful way how the Lord's eyes are always upon us. He looks out for the widow and the oppressed. And here when Hagar is blamed and abandoned by everyone else, the Lord stands by her side and he comforts her. He actually goes out to her. He's her advocate, her protector, her counselor. And I love the simple honesty of Hagar's answer to the Lord. I'm running away from my mistress Sarai. When we're asked by the Lord, where have you come from and where are you going? We should answer with the same kind of simple honesty. The Lord knows everything. He knows what's going on. It's silly for us to try to give him excuses and explanations. Just tell him the truth. Verse 9, then the angel of the Lord told her, go back to your mistress and submit to her. The angel added, I will so increase your descendants that they will be too numerous to count. So the Lord tells her, go back to your mistress and submit to her. He doesn't release her from her obligations to Abraham and Sarah. She's part of that family, and the Lord tells her to go back to it. Even though it's bad there, even though it's very difficult, even though it's very painful for her, he says, I want you to go back. But she's not going back there alone. The Lord will be with her. In our lives, there are situations that we can find ourselves in that we want to run away from. But running from the situation is not always what the Lord wants us to do. He wants us to live a Christ-honoring life in the midst of real life, with all of its problems and circumstances. You may be in the middle of what you think is a terrible situation that's pressing you beyond your limits. I want you to know that you are not alone. God may not take you out of the situation, but he won't let you go through it alone. I think it's a tragedy that in our modern culture, we are so often told to cut and run if it gets hard. Oh, is that situation you're in hard? Oh, well, then you just need to get out of it. You just need to go run away. Find an easy thing. That doesn't take any courage or character. It doesn't take any courage or character. We shouldn't base our decisions to run away or stay based on how hard something is. We should base it on what the Lord wants us to do, no matter how hard or easy it is. We need to choose to obey the Lord and trust Him to give us the strength to face the difficulty. The Lord does something extraordinary and unexpected here. He blesses Hagar and he gives her a promise similar to the one that he gave Abraham. He tells her that she will have many descendants, too numerous to count. Hagar is one of the few people in the entire Bible that are ever honored with a promise on this kind of scale. And who is she? She's a maidservant from Egypt. A virtual nobody. I love it when the Lord takes a person that the world has cast off as useless and he rescues them. He blesses them. He gives them a promise and he infuses their life with worth and glory that no one would have ever expected. He does that with Hagar. He's still doing that with people. There are people in this room like that, aren't there? People that he has infused with value, with worth, with glory. Who were cast off by the world. He loves to rescue people. He loves to do the unexpected with people. Verse 11, it says, "The angel of the Lord also said to her, 'You are now with child, and you will have a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery.' He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brothers." Ishmael. It means God hears. God hears. Every time Hagar would call her son's name, she will be reminded of the truth that God hears. That God heard her. That God came out to her in the desert of her life and rescued her. Gave her hope. Gave her a future. When everyone else had abandoned her, he saved her. Ishmael, God hears. It's interesting to note, though, that the name Ishmael has come to mean outcast. For example, the opening words of one of the greatest American novels ever written, Moby Dick, begin with the words, "Call me Ishmael. Call me outcast." But outcast is not what that name Ishmael meant when the Lord gave it to this child. It meant, and it means, God hears. Verse 13, she gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. "You are the God who sees me." For she said, I have now seen the one who sees me. That is why the well was called Beer La'ai Roi. It is still there between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar gives a name to the Lord. The name she gives God is, "You are the God who sees me." People give names to other people. They give names to animals, to places, to things. But rarely do people give a name to God. Hagar is an exception. And what makes this even more amazing is that God accepts the name that she gives him. And what a great name it is. You are the God who sees me. She had seen the one who sees her. I love that expression. It reminds me of 1 Corinthians 13:12, where Paul writes, "Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known." This well's name means literally, "Well of the living one who sees me." The Lord had seen her suffering, and he came and met her out in that desert and let her know that he had seen her suffering and that he cared for her. Verse 15 closes the story. It says, "So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son she had born. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael." So Hagar returned to the home of Abraham and Sarah like the Lord told her to do, and I'm struck by this woman's courage and faith and obedience. No wonder the Lord honors her with such blessing and promise. Because see, when she gets back, things didn't change much. They didn't change at all. Sarah still mistreats her. But it's what the Lord told Hagar to do, and she did it, trusting that the Lord would help her through it. Powerful example that she sets for us. In closing, there are four things that stand out for us in this story that I want to remind us of. First, Sarah and Abraham's faith in the Lord gets distracted by the circumstances that appear to be getting in the way of the fulfillment of God's promise. And as a result, they take on responsibility that is not theirs. They attempt to fulfill God's plan in their own effort. They should have waited for God's miracle. We can't let the circumstances of our life shake our faith in God's promises. He's faithful. We need to trust him. Second, God comes and comforts Hagar, this young, pregnant woman who has been blamed and abandoned by everyone. And he lets her see the one who sees her. He blesses her with a promise that few others ever receive. And he lets her give him a name. "You are the God who sees me." The Lord is the one who sees us too. Even when everyone else refuses, he cares for us, he loves us, he knows about our suffering and our pain. We are never alone and beyond his caring, watchful eye. He is the God who sees me. Third, Hagar's courage and faith and obedience to the Lord in returning to the home of Abraham and Sarah is noteworthy. Even in the face of more bad stuff waiting for her when she gets back, she's a powerful example to trust the Lord even when things are hard. Finally, even though it looks like Sarah and Abraham have made a complete mess of God's plan for them, His plan will be fulfilled in spite of it. He's going to give them a son of their own. His name is going to be Isaac. We can make some pretty big messes in our lives. But God has a way of taking our worst stuff and turning it into good. And if you're sitting here this morning thinking that your life is ruined because of something you've done or something that someone else has done, I want to tell you that your life is not ruined. Come to the Lord and lay it out before Him. Trust Him. Follow Him. He has not left you. He's not going to leave you. He's the God who sees you. He's the God who sees you. Psalm 33:18. Close with this. It says, the eyes of the Lord are on those who fear Him, on those whose hope is in His unfailing love, to deliver them from death and keep them alive in famine. We wait in hope for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. In Him our hearts rejoice, for we trust in His holy name. May Your unfailing love rest upon us, O Lord, even as we put our hope in You. Amen. Let's bow our heads. Father, You are the God who sees us. What a precious thought that is. To know that You know. Nothing escapes Your eye, Lord. I want to pray for those here this morning who need to be encouraged, Lord, and reminded of Your love and Your steadfast promises. That they've not been forgotten, Lord. They have not been abandoned by You. God, I pray right now that here this morning, even now, that they would know that You have gone out into the desert of their life to rescue them, Lord. Help us to take hold of You and trust You, Lord. In the midst of everything that we face in our life, we are not alone. Bless each one in Christ's name. Amen.